Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 117 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I am an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Our mission here at Dermasphere is to update you, dear listeners, on some of the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology with scintillating and lively discussions so you can learn and be entertained and not have to flip through a bunch of journal articles looking for what is relevant. I want to talk about an article first. It's from 2018, and I remember hearing at a conference that omega-3 fatty acids could help with some of the side effects of isotretinoin. And I wanted to look up the article and some of the information for myself. So this is a pretty good one that I found. It's called, Is Oral Omega-3 Effective in Reducing Mucocutaneous Side Effects of Isotretinoin in Patients with Acne Vulgaris? It is from a journal called Dermatology Research and Practice, and the authors include Mina Mirnazami and Hoda Rahimi out of Iran.
Very cool.
So this is a randomized double-blind trial. It had 118 patients on isotretinoin. They were on 0.5 mg/kg per day, which is a bit low for our standards in the United States. I think most of us go to 1 mg/kg per day, but I feel like in other countries they're a little bit gentler with their isotretinoin, perhaps because they don't have to deal with iPledge and perhaps because Americans like to just get her done. So these patients were on isotretinoin plus placebo or isotretinoin plus omega-3 fatty acids. And indeed, just as I had learned, the group of patients on the omega-3 fatty acids had fewer xerotic side effects from the isotretinoin. Specifically, they noticed less chylitis, less xerosis, less dry nose, and less dry eyes, though the dry eyes were only at week 4 that was relevant for some reason. The omega-3 fatty acids were dosed at 1 gram daily and were just stuff you could buy over the counter.
A gram of omega fatty acid, omega-3 fatty acid. Sounds good. Go ahead.
Part of me wondered if it also helps absorption of the medicine, because we always say to take it with a fatty meal. They didn't really mention that specifically, but it's at least a little bit of fat that goes in there and potentially could help absorption, I suppose.
Intriguing.
That's the most important stuff to come out of this, but I learned some more stuff about omega-3 fatty acids here. For example, they cannot be produced by the human body, so you need to eat them. They are found in fish oils, which I suppose is why sometimes the supplement is just called fish oil, and also some plants, according to the article here. But per the internet, you can find them in canola oil, Brussels sprouts, walnuts, flaxseed, chia seeds, hemp seeds, edamame, seaweed, and algae. Michelle, can I interest you in a heaping bowl of algae?
You know, algae is one of the best superfoods out there. Hard to sort of consume if you haven't prepped it in the right way, but it can be very, very nutritious.
The article says that omega-3 fatty acids are, quote, without any major side effect. Per the internet and, you know, the NIH, that's fairly accurate, except you can get a fishy taste. You can get a GI upset. You can get, quote, eructation. Michelle, do you know what eructation is?
Eructation. How do you spell that?
E-R-U-C-T-A-T-I-O-N. No fair looking it up.
Not going to look it up. Does it have something to do with how you hear things?
It's burping. It's the medical term for burping.
How could I not? Well, you do hear burp, so haha.
That's true.
Very exciting.
The pimping bell should ring because this is highly testable.
Oh, very. You'd have to know that name, yes. What about anticoagulation?
So they didn't mention that, but I think from our experience in doing Mohs surgery and other skin surgeries, people on fish oil sometimes bleed more than patients on aspirin or other blood thinners.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. It doesn't look like there's a whole lot of evidence based behind that, but it does make you kind of curious about it. It says they found no evidence to contravene the statement that the US FDA approved package inserts for omega-3 fatty acids do not produce clinically significant bleeding episodes. So probably not a huge effect.
But interesting, perhaps an area for future research. And according to a site on the internet, some of these Omega-3 fatty acid supplements also have other vitamins in them as well, so you just want to make sure you're not loading your patient up with too much vitamin A if they're already on isotretinoin, for example. Other things omega-3s have been shown to do is decrease serum triglycerides. In fact, there was a study published in JAMA Derm in 2015 that used omega-3 fatty acids specifically to improve hypertriglyceridemia in isotretinoin patients. Apparently, omega-3s also increase your HDL, though I'm still not sure that's clinically relevant or not. And apparently, there's clinical studies show that it can help treat depression.
Intriguing.
Derivatives from omega-3s are anti-inflammatory. They can maybe help eczema. They can maybe help prevent allergic diseases. They help dry eye, including that related to contact lenses. They reduce epidermal water loss. And they can even perhaps protect against rheumatoid arthritis, type 2 diabetes, autoimmune disorders, cardiovascular diseases, and malignancies. Seems like everybody should want to take them. I don't mind a little eructation.
Even if it smells or tastes like fish?
I might mind if it smells or tastes or sounds like fish. But overall, this is cool. This is sort of an added thing we can do. Perhaps just all of our patients on isotretinoin should be on omega-3s, 1 gram a day. Maybe also antihistamines. We discussed that in a previous article as well that can help with some of these xerotic side effects, especially if those of us in America are going to go big or go home. We can help ease the way with just adding some omega-3 fatty acids. I like it.
I like it too. That's pretty cool, Luke. Very interesting. A low-cost thing that you can supplement, not too terribly expensive. You do have to be thoughtful about contamination. So you have to watch out for the possibility of mercury contamination, especially if your omega-3 fatty acids are derived from fish. So they have to be very carefully sourced if you have a fish oil-derived omega-3. Flaxseed oil is another good source of omega-3 fatty acids. And unlike fish-sourced omega-3, you might not have to worry so much about mercury contamination. The chia seeds thing is fun. I actually have some of my patients who have chronically dry skin kind of get in the chia seed pudding habit, which is actually quite tasty. And it's a good way to balance out, you know, your diet. It's helpful in terms of fiber content and moisture. Chia seeds were used as a superfood by, amongst other people, like Aztec hunters. They would actually take that before they went out on a hunt, and it would help hydrate them throughout their kind of journey, which is kind of cool.
Plus, those of us who are our age know about chia pets.
Cha-cha-cha-chia!
Thank you. For what it's worth, the company they used in this study was Nature Made, which is just a very common over-the-counter supplement company. I'm sure you could buy these online for like $12.
Probably. I like that.
That's all I want to say about omega-3s, Michelle.
So I was going to look at this tofacitinib article first, but I think that there's a better tie-in with the autoimmune and autoinflammatory connective tissue disorders following COVID-19, since you kind of talked about the possibilities of decreasing the rates of that or decreasing the activity of several immune-related diseases with omega-3 fatty acid supplementation. Perhaps that's a nice tie-in. So
it's
we have
a great tie-in. Well, spoilers, we might talk about tofacitinib later.
Yes, just stay tuned. Stay tuned. So looking into this article from JAMA Open Network, this is an original investigation from the infectious disease section of this journal entitled Autoimmune and Autoinflammatory Connective Tissue Disorders Following COVID-19. The first author is Sung Ha Lim, and the corresponding author is Solam Lee, and they are out of Korea. This is actually a retrospective population-based study that was conducted between October 8th of 2020 and December 31st of 2021 using nationwide data from the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency. The COVID-19 National Health Insurance Service cohort included individuals who received a diagnosis of COVID-19 by PCR testing and a control group with no evidence of COVID-19. And so they collected all of this data to try to determine if patients who had positive confirmation of COVID-19 infection had higher rates of autoimmune diseases than patients who did not. So what do you suspect the answer is, Luke?
Well, depressingly, I think they probably do have increased rates of autoimmune disease.
You are correct. So when they looked at this, the primary outcomes were incidence and risk of autoimmune and autoinflammatory connective tissue disorders following COVID-19. They looked at 32 covariates, including demographic, socioeconomic status, lifestyle factors, and comorbidity profiles. And those were balanced through inverse probability weighting. They did a very nice job of making their control population look as much as possible like their COVID-19 infected patients, with the exception of things they couldn't control. For example, of course, the patients who had been vaccinated had a lower risk of COVID-19 infection than the patients who were not vaccinated. That's intuitive. Also, they had higher rates of COVID-19 infection in patients who lived in urban centers versus rural centers, which, again, makes sense. The patient population that got COVID-19 versus the patient population that didn't had higher rates of hypertension, diabetes, dyslipidemia, COPD, chronic kidney disease, liver disease, atopic derm, allergic rhinitis, and asthma. So it was a sicker cohort of patients in general, but just by a small amount, that had COVID-19 positivity. So out of this study, they found 350,000 individuals and change with COVID-19. Their average age was about 52 years. Half of them were women. They had over 6 million controls. They had a very similar age distribution, about 52 years of age, half of them were women. They found that the risks of alopecia areata increased significantly. So you had an adjusted hazard ratio of 1.12 with a confidence interval of 1.05 to 1.19. Sometimes we talk about statistics on this podcast. So a hazard ratio is going to show you the number, the amount of increased risk of a person who's had an exposure. If you capture zero in the hazard ratio, that means it's not a significant finding. So when you're looking at hazard ratios, you want to see that zero is not captured. And in this case, it was not. So a small increase in the risk of alopecia areata.
Wait a sec. Isn't one also really important?
Oh, like, so sorry.
If the hazard ratio includes one, that means apologies.
You're right. I'm thinking about
same.
A different statistic. You are correct. I'm thinking about a different statistic. You're right. This is, so if your hazard ratio captures one, my apologies. That means it would be a like one-to-one correlation, which means there's no increase or decrease in risk. My apologies for
So zero would that. Be protective.
Zero would be protective. That's correct. That's correct. So patients who had alopecia totalis had a hazard ratio of 1.74, the confidence interval 1.39 to 2.17. ANCA vasculitis, their hazard ratio was significantly elevated 2.76 with the confidence interval 1.64 to 4.65. Crohn's disease increased hazard ratio of 1.68 and that confidence interval of 1.31 to 2.15, and sarcoidosis, hazard ratio of 1.59 with their confidence interval of 1 to 2.52. So that did capture one there. These were all higher risk in the COVID-19 group. The risk of alopecia totalis, psoriasis, vitiligo, vasculitis, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, RA, adult onset Still's, Sjogren's syndrome, ankylosing spondylitis, and sarcoid were associated with the severity of COVID-19. So sicker patients had a higher probability of developing those autoimmune diseases. And the authors make a convincing argument that patients who've had COVID-19, especially those who are severely ill, should have long-term surveillance to ensure that they have not developed autoimmune disorders that need other attention. Because COVID-19 is widespread and it is highly inflammatory, there's been a significant interest in the potential association with autoimmune disease. We feel that the SARS-CoV-2 virus seems to perturb self-tolerance and may trigger autoimmune reactions due to cross-reactivity with the antibodies that are formed to the virus that may cause the development of autoimmune disease. There's also the possibility that the cytokine storm, which can be part of severe infection, can cause tissue damage and breakdown of immune-privileged sites. So I think that the authors did a very nice job of analyzing this data. The only disease that they found a lower risk for was systemic lupus erythematosus. The authors thought that this might be due to the relatively short follow-up period that was a part of this database, as well as to the fact that patients who were more severely ill or more likely to have significant autoinflammatory disease may have potentially died from COVID-19, thereby kind of removing them from the risk pool. They also analyzed men and women separately. Women showed increased risks of alopecia areata, alopecia totalis, vitiligo, ANCA-associated vasculitis, Crohn's disease, and sarcoidosis than when they had COVID-19 versus patients who did not. When they did a subgroup analysis of only men, they found an increased risk of alopecia totalis, psoriasis, Crohn's disease, adult onset Still's, systemic sclerosis, and ankylosing spondylitis. They also stratified the data by age and found that there was a higher risk of alopecia areata and ANCA-associated vasculitis in patients over the age of 40. whereas the risks of Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, and adult onset Still's and sarcoid were higher in patients younger than 40 years that had COVID-19 versus patients who did not. The COVID-19 vaccination rate was influential in the assessment of the data as well as in some of the capture. In Korea, they were very cautious about vaccinating adolescents and children, and so that somewhat skewed the data toward the adult population. But I do think that the hypotheses that we have potentially triggering of autoimmunity due to activation through tissue antigens, cross-reactive antibodies, as well as tissue damage due to the cytokine storm with activation of inflammatory cytokines like IL-6 and IL-1 might cause the ability for patients to express autoimmune disease after they've been infected with COVID-19. Interferon responses are also very important in COVID-19, and many patients will mount an early robust defense through the activation of the interferon responses against viral infections. That interferon can be a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing. It can be a double-edged sword. So high levels of interferon can induce hyperinflammation and can exacerbate the severity of COVID-19 and may be associated with increased mortality, as well as being associated with the pathogenesis of autoimmune disorders like vitiligo and alopecia areata. So I think that there's a convincing argument that patients who've had COVID-19, especially severe COVID-19, may be at greater risk for autoimmune disease and should be appropriately screened in their follow-up.
Tell me again what the time frame was for this article.
So they gathered data from October 8th, 2020 to December 31st, 2021.
So they followed patients for like a year to see if they developed any of these things?
It appears that was about the follow-up time that the patients were subjected to, yes.
That's not very long.
Yeah. And autoimmune disease can be, you know, something that develops over time. We also all know that there are sort of smoldering autoimmune diseases that take time to present. And, you know, there's not uniform screening for these patients. So I think that there's a few important points to pull out of the article. If you have a patient that had COVID-19 that had a severe infection, you certainly might want to follow them more carefully. From a personal experience standpoint, a lot of hospital labs and reference lab ANAs or antinuclear antibody panels will be a little bit complicated in how they pick up a U1RNP antibody, which can be positive in mixed connective tissue disease. And so that U1RNP antibody is sometimes positive in isolation with a negative ANA. So if you have a patient that has an autoimmune phenotype and you do an ANA and it's negative, you may want to add the U1RNP depending on your reference lab's capabilities, because some patients will have a positive U1RNP but a negative ANA, and you might miss sort of developing either mixed connective tissue disease or brewing autoimmunity.
The lupus thing is kind of interesting. It looks like the hazard ratio is 0.5, mm-hmm. meaning that if you have COVID and you survive, you're half as likely to get lupus in the next year, I suppose, compared to somebody who didn't. And tell me again how the vaccine plays a role. Were vaccinated people less likely to get autoimmune diseases, I hope?
Vaccinated people were less likely to get autoimmune disease and also less likely, of course, to get COVID-19. And that's, you know, reassuring data, because I know there's been some people who have been concerned about the vaccines themselves triggering autoimmunity. That's not been demonstrated well to this point, but of course people are going to continue to investigate that as is appropriate. I think they also highlighted well the participation of the inflammatory cascade and the endothelia of the vasculature, which can be infected with COVID-19 and maybe a substrata where autoimmunity forms. Neutrophils becoming activated in the vascular endothelia and sort of exposing some of their own antigens may be one of the reasons for that increase that was seen in ANCA-associated vasculitis, which was one of the highest hazard ratios in the study. So I think that there's definitely vigilance is recommended and I think is very appropriate under those circumstances.
It's interesting, and I like their hypotheses as to why COVID could be unique in this realm, but is it really COVID, or could any illness potentially be associated with this increase of autoimmune disease? Because we don't really understand, well, we understand a lot, but there's plenty we don't understand about autoimmune disease. So I often tell my patients and their families, well, we think there's something about your genes that puts you at risk, and then something triggers those genes to become active. And when we don't really understand stuff, we like to blame viruses. So maybe just any old virus can sort of trigger these genes to become active. So is it really COVID? Like for alopecia areata, for example, we, I think, have a pretty good idea that some viral infection could be responsible for triggering this phenomenon. And I wonder how much of that is true with these other issues as well.
I think that we have good paradigms for infectious diseases triggering autoimmune responses, because it's basically a misfire of the immune system when this happens, and tissue damage can occur with viral infections that can reveal antigens that should have remained hidden from the immune system. You know, we have good paradigms even for bacterial infections, with strep potentially triggering psoriasis. So I think that it's part of the sort of complexity of our immune system that the very things that it's designed to protect us against can sometimes be the match that lights the gasoline for an autoimmune disease in a patient who's genetically predisposed.
But is it COVID specifically? Or no. Is COVID just an example of one match, perhaps an especially fiery match?
I think that it's any virus can do it. I think that any infection can do it. I think a lot of exposures can do it, toxic exposures for sure. You know, I think that stress dysregulates our immune system and can sometimes cause us to develop autoimmune disease because of that dysregulation. So really anything that causes tissue damage, activates or dysregulates the immune system, and, you know, patients that have even environmental exposures can have a triggering of the autoimmune disease. There are case reports of things like vitiligo happening after vaccination and primary infection with COVID-19. But in that sort of case, it might be difficult to suss out if it was the infection or if it was the vaccine that had caused that autoimmune disease to present.
Well, the one other thing I'll mention about this article before we move on is I found the sarcoidosis thing kind of interesting, assuming we think it's real, even though the hazard ratio just barely included one. Mm-hmm. I think some of us were thinking that at some point we would discover that sarcoid itself was an infectious disease, like a mycobacterium or something that we just hadn't found yet because it's granulomatous inflammation. But this suggests that it's, you know, autoimmune, I suppose.
That is an interesting question. Some people do hypothesize that sarcoidosis is some kind of cell wall deficient variant of a mycobacterium, and that the patients that develop sarcoid have genetic vulnerability to that organism. And, you know, its pattern of distribution, especially when you get the lesions around the mouth, its ability to form somewhat miliary lesions, all of those things remind us a lot of other mycobacterial infections. And I don't think that that chapter has been completely closed yet. I know people are continuing to investigate that. Sarcoidosis is a complex and fascinating disease, so I think that we have more to learn about it.
Well, Michelle, I don't really like autoimmune disease or COVID, but you know what I do like?
What? Kids?
Babies.
Woohoo!
And I like France. So I want to talk about a study about French babies. This is out of Pediatric Dermatology and is called Transient Abdominal Telangiectasia of the Newborn. Hmm. Authors include Cécile Jouzeau and Sébastien Barbaro. And it's a short article about a newly described entity. It's a case series of 20 newborn French babies. It may have also been Canadian babies. Yes, French and Canadian babies, who had transient large telangiectatic patches on the abdomen in a, quote, butterfly distribution. They were on average 7 days old. Range was 1 to 20 days of age, and they were equal boys and girls. All of them were born at term, and most had normal clinical exams, though 6 of the 20 had abdominal distension, and 1 had poor weight gain due to poor breastfeeding. Step it up, baby. 14 of these babies underwent abdominal ultrasound, which was normal in 10 of the 14. In the other 4, the following was discovered on ultrasound: incidental bilateral ovarian cysts, a pelvic mass, which turned out to be a rhabdomyosarcoma.
Intriguing.
That ain't good. Stercoral stasis, which I believe means constipation. Now, that patient had Hirschsprung disease, so that's pretty recognizable. And one patient had poorly visualized mesenteric vessels in the context of abdominal distension. But whether these babies had ultrasound or not, and whether the ultrasound found any abnormalities or not, and whether they had abdominal distension on exam or not, these telangiectatic patches resolved by about 3 months of age. So this is supposedly a benign finding that you might find in newborn babies, and you can generally reassure parents and caregivers. However, if there's potentially a pathologic cause of increased abdominal pressure, then you want to properly explore that. They say the presumed pathogenesis is at least some increased intra-abdominal pressure that results in impaired venous return and then some dilated capillaries, etc. So it seems like oftentimes this kind of just happens, but if they do have something on their exam or other investigation that makes you suspicious that they could have a more malignant reason to have a distended abdomen, then of course you want to investigate it.
I like that. That's very interesting. Have you ever been consulted for that, Luke?
Nope. But maybe someday I will, and then I'll look super smart and French. The pictures show they're pretty large. They're like, they occupy a good half of the abdomen, sort of extending across the bottom two quadrants, these telangiectatic patches.
I like that. I think that sounds very interesting to know that and be able to reassure parents that generally things are going to be absolutely fine, even with a remarkable finding like that in the neonatal period.
One of the coolest things about being a pediatric dermatologist is those moments when you get to say, aha, nobody else knows what that is, but I know what it is, and it's nothing to worry about. Good feelings.
I love it. I love it. Well, Luke, I got a question for you. What were you doing in 1997?
I was 17 years old, so I was probably playing Dungeons and Dragons and doing theater in high school.
Very cool. In 1997, we also got the premiere of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We lost the notorious B.I.G. and Princess Di, tragically. And the first camera phone came out, as well as the song Barbie Girl by Aqua, the first one, not the remake that has recently come out with the Barbie movie. Also in 1997, cyclosporine was first approved for dermatologic use for psoriasis. So this article is going to look at some of the cousins of cyclosporine, systemic calcineurin inhibitors tacrolimus and voclosporin, a review of off-label dermatologic uses from the JAD by authors Annie Dai and Soojung Kim. Soojung Kim is a friend of ours. She actually worked here at the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful sunny Lubbock, Texas for a while before going to Houston, where she is now.
What's up, Soojung Kim?
Woo-woo! Dermosphere shout out. So this article aims to look at the systemic calcineurin inhibitors, specifically tacrolimus and voclosporin. These have been used in various dermatologic conditions, and there are off-label dermatologic indications with published guidelines for things like cyclosporin, but there's no consensus for tacrolimus or voclosporin. Voclosporin, if you haven't heard of it before, do not despair. It was only recently approved in 2021. It is a novel calcineurin inhibitor that was developed for the treatment of lupus nephritis. It can cause acute and chronic nephrotoxicity, so that feels a little counterintuitive, but that is what the medication has been approved for. As many new medications are, the voclosporin is quite expensive. It is about $7,000 to $8,000 per month and about $90-something thousand dollars per year. The tacrolimus and cyclosporin have gotten very reasonable. With a coupon, you can get them for as little as $18 a month for 30 day supply, which is pretty decent. So this was a review of off-label uses of systemic tacrolimus and voclosporin in different diagnoses to inform treatment methods. They did a search using PubMed and Google Scholar, and they pulled relevant clinical trials, observational studies, case series, and reports for off-label dermatologic uses of tacrolimus and voclosporin. Tacrolimus shows a lot of promise for numerous dermatologic conditions, including psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, pyoderma gangrenosum and chronic urticaria, as well as potentially Behçet's disease, especially with intestinal involvement. Little spoiler alert for later. Randomized controlled data are only available for voclosporin in psoriasis. It was studied in psoriasis to see if it might be an efficacious treatment for patients with plaque psoriasis, and it was found to be effective, but it was non-inferior to did not meet non-inferiority analysis to cyclosporin. So that trial didn't really seem to go forward after that point. So in comparison to cyclosporin, tacrolimus could potentially be considered for treatment refractory disease, particularly in patients with cardiovascular risk factors, because tacrolimus has a favorable cardiovascular risk profile in comparison to cyclosporin. It is also better absorbed in the intestine than cyclosporin, so may be attractive if you have any kind of inflammatory bowel disease or Behçet's with intestinal involvement. Voclosporin's only been used in psoriasis in trials. It is effective, but it is not non-inferior to cyclosporin. It is used predominantly for lupus nephritis patients. So the systemic calcineurin inhibitors include cyclosporin, tacrolimus, and voclosporin. These are immunosuppressive drugs. They're primarily used in organ transplantation. They have immunomodulatory mechanism that is involving inhibiting interleukin-2 and disrupting T-cell activation. The original, the OG, calcineurin inhibitor, cyclosporin, has been around for a long time and has a well-established history of use in dermatology. Tacrolimus and voclosporin are newer agents. They have increased potency and relatively more favorable side effects. When we're talking about cyclosporin, it has been used with guidelines for atopic dermatitis and urticaria. There are scarce studies on tacrolimus and voclosporin, and there's no approved dermatologic uses of tacrolimus or voclosporin, but they have been utilized off-label by several authors in case reports. So they did a nice search from articles from 1990 to 2022 for calcineurin inhibitors, tacrolimus, voclosporin, and dermatology treatment and off-label. Tacrolimus was discovered from soil fungus. It was from Streptomyces. Okay, I'm going to try this. Tsukubiensis. It was approved in 1994 as a cyclosporin alternative to prevent liver transplant rejection. And they are structurally different, tacrolimus and cyclosporin, but they have similar mechanisms of action. So tacrolimus binds to immunophilin proteins and makes a complex that inhibits calcineurin's phosphatase activity. That
ding,
means...
Ding, ding,
yeah, sorry. It's hard for me to ring the bell when I'm doing the thing. I need to get you a bell. So nuclear factor of activated T cells is then not activated. So NFAT, that is a kind of transcription factor that sort of regulates early gene transcription in T cells and also affects the activity of the T cell receptor. So nuclear factor of activated T cells is not activated when you have tacrolimus on board that prevents transcription of interleukin 2 and other cytokines for T cell activation and maintenance. Tacrolimus is about 100 times more potent than cyclosporin to suppress T cell activation, and they share relatively similar side effect profiles. This is very pimpable. They are nephrotoxic. They can cause hypertension, neurotoxicity, gastrointestinal upset, and infections. Differences in side effects between tacrolimus and cyclosporin include that cyclosporin is more associated with hirsutism, hypercholesterolemia, and hypertension, as well as gingival hyperplasia. Tacrolimus has an improved cardiovascular risk profile that actually has improved blood pressure and lipid profiles compared to cyclosporin. Tacrolimus is more associated with alopecia and new onset diabetes post-transplant, so that's important to be aware of. Tacrolimus has less early nephrotoxicity than cyclosporin, but is comparable in terms of its chronic nephrotoxicity. When they looked at immunosuppressants and compared cyclosporin to low-dose tacrolimus, low-dose tacrolimus had the highest mean GFR, which means the kidneys were working the best for those patients, but the decreased nephrotoxicity of tacrolimus over cyclosporin is still somewhat debated. There aren't any approved dermatologic uses of tacrolimus, but there have been trials, retrospective case studies, as well as case series, looking at the use of this medication in psoriasis, eczema, urticaria, pyoderma gangrenosum, Behçet's disease, and graft versus host disease. And so in all of those conditions, there's been some evidence for improvement with psoriasis. Short-term treatment for refractory psoriasis with tacrolimus may be beneficial and may be favorable over cyclosporin because of the favorable side effect profile, especially in patients with cardiovascular risk factors. The benefit to psoriasis was, as many of these medications are, discovered accidentally in patients who received liver or heart transplants and also had psoriasis, and then their psoriasis got better because of the transplant, the anti-rejection medications for the transplant. The studies have been relatively small, but have favorably shown no significant life-threatening side effects. The side effects included diarrhea, abdominal pain, paresthesia, and myalgia. Small increases in creatinine were seen at week 12 in this study of 50 patients, and patients that had tacrolimus didn't have any significant abnormalities with the neurologic system, which is good. The side effects for tacrolimus were dose-dependent, including an increase in creatinine, hyperkalemia, just like cyclosporin can do, hypertension, hyperglycemia, which is more significant for tacrolimus than cyclosporin, diarrhea, paresthesias, and insomnia. When atopic derm was looked into, tacrolimus is rarely used as opposed to cyclosporin, which I think many of us have experience using cyclosporin in refractory eczema. There haven't been any trials to directly compare cyclosporine to tacrolimus, but older patients with atopic dermatitis may have increased odds of cardiovascular comorbidities and higher levels of atherosclerosis. So tacrolimus's improved cardiovascular profile may be beneficial in those patients. For pyoderma gangrenosum, tacrolimus is indicated as a third-line therapeutic. If patients have inflammatory bowel disease, tacrolimus is favored because it has better intestinal absorption and more predictable bioavailability. And inflammatory bowel disease can be associated with pyoderma gangrenosum, so those two conditions may be present in the same patient. If you have a patient that has chronic urticaria, that is also something tacrolimus can potentially be used as an alternative for as a treatment. The patients that are refractory to antihistamines may benefit from tacrolimus as it inhibits histamine release. And tacrolimus may be beneficial over cyclosporine because it doesn't carry the risks of hirsutism and gingival hyperplasia. With Behçet's disease, cyclosporine is often used for refractory or ocular Behçet's disease. Tacrolimus may be considered as an alternative, especially if there is intestinal involvement present. And patients may actually have clinical remission and endoscopic healing of recalcitrant intestinal Behçet's disease with tacrolimus. So I think that's a very exciting possibility. And finally, for graft versus host disease, the cyclosporine or tacrolimus can both be used for GVHD prophylaxis. Calcineurin inhibitors are initiated for GVHD when patients have a lack of response or disease progression on prednisone. There is not a standard for second-line GVHD treatment. Studies have had some mixed results, but patients may do better on tacrolimus versus cyclosporine. Patients with severe GVHD that don't respond to prednisone are a very difficult cohort of patients to treat. So that, of course, needs to be borne in mind when you're looking at those studies. So whenever you're looking at these medications, of course, you want to look at the side effect profiles and the patient in front of you and decide what the best fit is for both circumstances. With voclosporin, the long and short of it is that they really didn't find an appropriate use of it outside of the treatment of acute lupus nephritis. Since it was not non-inferior to cyclosporin, the use of this medication, especially considering its cost, is not going to be likely to be prevalent for patients with psoriasis. But these are two medications that are calcineurin inhibitors that may be appropriate medications for recalcitrant patients, especially for patients who for whom we cannot get access to the newer biologics or small molecule inhibitors because the costs of cyclosporine and tacrolimus have come down significantly in recent years, and you can get a month-long supply of either one of those for about $18 with a coupon.
I was interested in looking into this article because I had a patient and we were thinking of starting cyclosporin. And she said, why do you guys use cyclosporin in dermatology? Why not tacrolimus or tacrolimus, however you pronounce it? And I said, I don't know. And oftentimes when I don't know and things don't make sense, it's either because of some historical accident or tradition or something along those lines. So I suspect that we use cyclosporine in dermatology because it happens to be the first one discovered to have been effective for psoriasis, and then it started getting studied, and now that's kind of the one we use. But I wonder if tacrolimus would be better. I love topical tacrolimus. Well, if you're thinking of starting somebody on cyclosporine and you think you might want to use tacrolimus instead, it sounds like the side effect profiles are pretty comparable, but sounds like tacrolimus might be a little bit more tolerable. This article has some nice dosing instructions as well in a table if you want to take a look and dose your patients the way it's been studied. Maybe you want to treat your patients with alopecia totalis or alopecia universalis with tacrolimus. Or maybe you want to use methotrexate. That's what we're going to talk about in our next article. It's out of JAMA Dermatology, and it's called Efficacy of Methotrexate Alone versus Methotrexate Plus Low-Dose Prednisone in Patients with Alopecia Areata Totalis or Universalis, a two-step double-blind randomized clinical trial. Authors include Pascal Joly and Pascal Regagny. That's right, two different Pascals, again, out of France. So, alopecia areata, we know, oftentimes spontaneously just remits, but oftentimes it doesn't and can be pretty tough, though we've had some better options for it lately. See episode 111 about ritlecitinib and episode 87 about baricitinib, for example. But the alopecia totalis and universalis forms are especially tough, both in terms of quality of life. This article says that Alopecia totalis or universalis has got impacts on the quality of life comparable to hidradenitis suppurativa, which we know is particularly miserable. And also they are usually quite recalcitrant. And Michelle, you gave me a nice mnemonic to remember. Alopecia universalis is the whole body and alopecia totalis is the head, because aliens from the universe don't have any hair on their body. You know, like the little green men or little gray creatures. And this study looks specifically at patients with alopecia universalis or totalis that did indeed get improvement with methotrexate plus prednisone. It's a multi-center randomized clinical trial out of France. 89 adult patients were randomized to methotrexate, either 20 to 25 milligrams weekly based on their weight, or they took placebo. So no prednisone involved at this point. They just took methotrexate or placebo for 6 months. And if they had hair regrowth at that point, then they continued on whatever they were taking, methotrexate or placebo. And if they did not have hair regrowth, then they started methotrexate with prednisone or with placebo for the next 6 months. And if they took the prednisone with their methotrexate, it was 20 milligrams daily for 3 months and then 15 milligrams daily for 3 months. And they were all rechecked 1 year after starting this. So they had 6 months of methotrexate or placebo, and then they had 6 months of methotrexate plus placebo or methotrexate plus prednisone, basically. And the upshot is that 20 to 30% of patients on the methotrexate plus prednisone group had near complete regrowth at a year of age, compared with basically no one in the other groups. Again, 20 to 30%, which is, you know, a substantial minority. They did say that there were a few methotrexate-only patients who had a near-complete response. There were a couple of them who did. A couple of them is a pretty low number, but it's possible. They often just had partial regrowth. And so this improvement of 20 to 30% basically complete regrowth is pretty comparable or even better than those JAK inhibitors I mentioned earlier. So, for example, baricitinib and ritlecitinib both showed that about a third of patients had near complete regrowth after a year, but that was everybody, including sort of the patchy alopecia patients. I feel like I remember that the patients with alopecia universalis or totalis, their regrowth was more like 10% on these JAK inhibitors, so perhaps this is better. Obviously, methotrexate plus prednisone is a lot cheaper than the JAK inhibitors. However, the side effect profile is likely worse. The authors of this study say that their patients didn't get any serious adverse events, and they attribute this possibly to the relatively low dose of prednisone they were taking. For example, they say, well, our patients were on 20 to 15 milligrams of prednisone, which is pretty small because other studies of prednisone with alopecia areata had patients on like half a mg per kg. I did wonder, though, why they picked 20 milligrams and 15 milligrams rather than something weight-based. This is a French study, so I assume they're skinny people in France, so perhaps this is like 0.2 to 0.5 milligrams per kilograms per day. And what do you do after a year? Do you try to taper off the prednisone? Do you plan on keeping them on methotrexate like forever? But I suppose you can ask the same thing about the JAK inhibitors too. There's just sort of like not a good option. I suspect that what we'll do in practice is try to get people pretty good and slowly taper off whatever we're using. That's usually what we do. That's tends to be what we do with biologics, for example. It looks like these authors do try to taper the prednisone in practice, but they do note that this is a limitation of this approach since some patients become corticosteroid dependent. And in this study, 7 patients who had achieved complete regrowth were followed forward. Their stats were included here. So 6 years later, 5 of these 7 patients still had pretty good hair regrowth with a SALT score of less than 40%. That means they had lost less than 40% of their scalp hair. 3 out of these 7 had stopped treatment, so they weren't doing anything. Doesn't tell us if these were some of the people who still had good hair regrowth or not. The 4 patients who were still on treatment were on prednisone at a mean dose of 8.7 milligrams per day and still on methotrexate at a mean dose of 11.6 milligrams per week. So indeed, we tried to taper them off, but we were not always successful. In these patients, there were 2 adverse events likely related to the prednisone, osteoporosis, and a Cushingoid face. That's pretty annoying. But still, Since this does seem comparable to these new fancy approved drugs, we should probably consider it. It did make me try to remember what I'm supposed to do for patients who are on chronic prednisone, calcium, vitamin D, DEXA scans, bisphosphonates, skin cancer screenings, PJP prophylaxis, acid reducers. I think perhaps I'll have to look up an article about the recommendations and discuss it in a future episode.
Well, that was a very interesting review of some novel uses for some older medications. So we're going to talk now about some novel uses for some novel medications. So this is an article about tofacitinib in recalcitrant bullous pemphigoid. This is a review of 7 cases. And this was published in the Journal of...
It was the BJD.
BJD, thank you. In 2022, my printout was a little funny, so I was having a little trouble finding that. And if we look at the authors, they are Birao Fan and Mingyue Wang, and they are out of Peking University First Hospital in Beijing, China. This is a letter to the editor discussing the fact that bullous pemphigoid is a Th2-oriented autoimmune blistering disease, and it's accompanied by severe pruritus. It typically affects older people. And it targets the NC16A BP180 non-collagenous domain of the BP180 antigen. And I'm looking for my bell. Hold on.
There we go.
We have our bell. So topical glucocorticoids and systemic glucocorticoids have been used in combination as primary therapy along with tetracyclines or dapsone or other immunosuppressants. But there are a few reports that suggest these treatments are sometimes ineffective in some patients. Biologics such as omalizumab, rituximab, and dupilumab have also been used for refractory bullous pemphigoid. This utilization of these therapies may be impaired by cost, inconvenience of drug administration, or side effects. Tofacitinib, which is not necessarily an inexpensive medication, is an oral Janus kinase inhibitor. It suppresses the activation of neutrophils and eosinophils and can relieve chronic pruritus by inhibiting interleukin-4 receptor alpha and through JAK1 signaling. So the authors hypothesized that tofacitinib could be clinically beneficial for patients who had intractable bullous pemphigoid. They enrolled 7 patients who ranged in age from 10 years old to 93 years old. And they wanted to have these patients assessed because they had previously responded to standard therapy, but all 7 had relapsed during withdrawal. 3 patients had failed 3-month dupilumab therapy and developed complications due to previous systemic glucocorticoid administration. And prior to initiation of the tofacitinib therapy, a mean disease duration was about 15 months. All the patients had a high BP180 NC16A specific IgG level, and 5 patients had elevated eosinophil levels. They also monitored key cytokines, including IL-6, TNF-alpha, and IL-17. All patients, including the 10-year-old, were given tofacitinib 5 milligrams twice daily. 4 patients received additional systemic glucocorticoids, 20 to 40 milligrams daily, and 3 patients received topical glucocorticoids 10 to 30 grams daily as an initial dosage. All patients, all 7, were free of itching 1 week after receiving tofacitinib. And this is a message we're hearing from the Janus kinase inhibitors, that they can be relatively rapid in the onset of relief from pruritus. Mean levels of serum autoantibody and eosinophils also both declined. And when patients achieved their disease control, they were able to taper off the glucocorticoids as the autoantibody and eosinophil levels decreased. Levels of IL-6, IL-17, and TNF-alpha also decreased when the patients had complete remission compared with levels before the administration of the JAK inhibitor. And over a follow-up period of 9 to 14 months, all 7 patients maintained a complete remission, 6 of which were off therapy, 1 of which was on therapy. The 10-year-old boy showed continuously positive BP180 NC16A specific IgG during his complete remission at last follow-up. So although clear of his lesions, he continued to take tofacitinib 5 milligrams daily to prolong his remission and minimize recurrence. This is very interesting because in bullous pemphigoid, the binding of antigens and autoantibodies can initiate Fc receptor-dependent events that lead to complement activation and mast cell degranulation, which can cause infiltration of inflammatory cells into the dermis, and then the secretion of itching and inflammatory mediators to increase pruritus and immune reactivity before the granulocytes at the DEJ produce proteolytic enzymes and end up causing a dermal-epidermal split. the JAK signal transducer and activator of transcription, STAT, pathway. So that's what signal transducer and activator of transcription, that's what STAT stands for, pathway, provides a bridge between the cytokines and intracellular communication that can contribute to immune cell functioning. So patients with BP were found to have higher levels of STAT3 and STAT5 expression. The JAK1, STAT3, STAT5 pathway mediates IL-6 and TNF-alpha signaling and promotes IL-17 transcription. So some of the bad boys of inflammation get increased when the JAK-STAT pathway is activated, specifically when you have STAT3 and STAT5 participating. It's kind of funny because like the fives tend to associate with eosinophils, like IL-5, STAT-5. It's kind of interesting.
Maybe that's on purpose because eosinophil starts with the fifth letter of the alphabet.
I like the way you think. The cytokines can activate Th2 cells and also recruit neutrophils and eosinophils into the tissue. So in recent years, they've looked into different therapies for bolus pemphigoid. JAK inhibitors act upstream to the inflammatory cascade of this autoimmune disease. Tofacitinib inhibits JAK1 and JAK3 over JAK2. It's approved for the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis and plaque psoriasis by the European Medicines Agency, because this study was done in not Europe, but it was done in Peking in China. In rheumatoid arthritis, tofacitinib has been found to inhibit IL-6, TNF-alpha, and IL-17 production in both B and T cells, and also causes a decrease in IL-17 and IL-6 levels. Peripheral blood mononuclear cell supernatant, which has all of these factors, and it was studied in this case series, and that was found to be true for these patients as well. Constitutive STAT3 and STAT5 phosphorylation in monocytes and T cells was also downregulated by tofacitinib. And neuronal JAK1 may mediate chronic itch experimentally. The reported cases may support tofacitinib as an alternative anti-inflammatory and antipruritic.
Yeah, that was an interesting little pearl to me, this business of JAK1 being involved potentially in neuronal itch. Mm-hmm. So it could be an option for your patients who are itchy without any other obvious reason to be itchy.
Yeah, it does make you wonder about things like severe notalgia paresthetica and things if that wouldn't be potentially treated well with a JAK inhibitor that was able to inhibit JAK1 well because of that mediation of chronic itch in the neuronal JAK1 expression. So I think that that's kind of exciting.
Or those patients for which we're like, well, I don't know, maybe some gabapentin or something.
Yes.
Obviously, gabapentin's like way cheaper and has a pretty good side effect profile. But you can imagine a future after we start our generic drug company featuring Toph from Avatar, where we provide super cheap tofacitinib, where this could potentially be an option.
That would be fantastic, because I think there are a lot of broad therapeutic applications for this drug. Now, of course, you have to bear in mind the incidence of venous thrombosis and the risk for infection. So screening for thrombolic and thromboembolic events and infectious events could be important in these patients. They didn't have any severe adverse effects in this case series, even in the 93-year-old male patient. So that's fairly decent evidence of tolerability. This study showed that tofacitinib may be a safe option for reducing the inflammation in patients that have bolus pemphigoid and may help decrease systemic corticosteroid use, which, as we know from previous reviews that we've done on this podcast, is certainly not without significant risk.
JAK inhibitors, they're the new thing. Is there anything they can't do? They're like the new doxycycline or dupilumab. They're just being used for everything. But I'm glad. I wish they were cheaper, so we got to get on that generic drug company idea. Well, that is all the time we have for today. So thank you, listeners, so much for joining us. And thanks also to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. And thank you also to all of the members of Team Dermosphere who work behind the scenes to keep things moving along. Most of them are fourth-year medical students currently applying to dermatology. So, program directors, please look kindly on their applications. The names you should be looking for include Morgan Dykman, Guy Cusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, and Laura Dela Cruz, though she's not applying right now. You can also find more of our content on YouTube and on ViewMedi, so there will be some links for that. Thanks again to Team Dermosphere for making those continue. We also have social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find us, I'm sorry, it's not called Twitter anymore, but whatever. You can also find us on our website, dermospherepodcast.com, which has links to all of the original articles, and is also a good way to get in touch with us. If you really like hanging out with members of University of Utah Department of Dermatology faculty, we also have a monthly Echo where you would be welcome to join us as well for some free CME, learn a little bit, present any difficult patients you have. We'd love to see you there. We'll see the rest of you guys in 2 weeks, 2 spooky weeks. Happy Halloween, everybody.
Happy Halloween.